was actually the first person other than my boss to walk into my office when I started at CSU in January 2008. And she's been with us ever since, which has been fabulous. So Lee is part of the executive advisory committee of, I like the advisory in the middle, by the way. It's of the Center for Collaborative Conservation, which is the seminar series that you're at. She's also a fellow of the center. If you have any questions about what our fellowship program is about, I think everybody in this room qualifies. So, and then we've got other fellows here. We've got at least one, Kathy. We've got another, Clement. Oh, okay. So we've got two other fellows here, and then some CCC staff members. But more interestingly, so Lee worked a long time, about 15 years for the Environmental Protection Agency, and she was working on Superfund stuff, and then she also was the lead for, and let me, I don't think it's on this one. She was the lead, yeah, okay, never mind. It's not on this one. It was another one I read. The lead for their tribal work at the EPA.
And tribal mediation.
Mediation work, okay. She has a master's in environmental conflict management, and is currently, and has been for a number of years, working with a variety of tribal nations. Today, she's going to tell us about that work, as well as her fellowship, which led her to go all across the country and visit many, many nations in this country. So she's going to talk to us about indigenous landscapes of mind, spirit, and place. Thank you for coming, and thank you, Lee, for coming.
Okay. I see my, I didn't capitalize my P, but I did. It was just a translation from one program to PowerPoint. Since there are, a finite number of us, can you just give me your name and your interest, what you do here at CSU? Would you mind?
My name is Dong Wei. Dong Wei.
Dong Wei?
Yes.
Okay. And you're here at CSU because?
Study.
Oh, in studying?
Yes.
And where are you from?
China.
Thank you. Okay. And Chaska?
Wait. I'm Chaska.
I know Chaska.
I'm also a graduate student at CSU.
Anna? With your mouth full.
I'm a designer and developer, and I'm interested in developing social networks and online communities. I work at the CCC also.
My name's Matt, and I'm a first-year PhD student in the graduate degree program in ecology. I'm on the USDA Matt Williams Fellowship. So I'm interested in looking at invasive species management on tribal lands, but working with traditional ecological knowledge to sort of actually make true adaptive management happen on the ground instead of just on paper.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
I'm Kathy. I am a PhD student in the Forest Rangeland Stewardship Department. And I'm working on looking at collaboration and stewardship contracting by the U.S. Forest Service as a means for rural community development and sustainability.
Okay. I'm Asuru. I'm a PhD student at the Forest Rangeland and Water Stewardship from Kenya. I work with some indigenous minorities across my country to conserve environment and improve food security.
Thank you.
I'm Faith Sternleaf. I'm a PhD candidate, and I'm anxious to hear you talk about your experiences with the CCC Fellowship and findings. So,
okay.
Fellow CCC supporter.
Yes.
I'm George, and I'm just here for in general interest of maintaining instruments on a research project.
Nice. Welcome.
My name is Erica Godin, and I'm a master's student in the graduate degree program for ecology, and I'm interested in wildlife on private lands.
Okay.
And my name is Shafra, I'm also in the PPE, and I'm interested in human disturbance and social spaces.
Okay.
I'm Lisa, and I work in the Indigenous and Natural Resources.
Okay.
I'm Connie. I got my master's here in philosophy and environmental ethics. I've been hanging with some Hawaiians on their fish pond in Molokai and would like to learn how to be useful.
Okay. We're just introducing ourselves briefly.
I'm Sonia Faber. I'm with the Forest and Rangeland Stewardship Department.
And Robin Reed.
Robin Reed, and I'm with the Center for Collaborative Conservation and also part of Sonia's department and part of the Human Dimension Department also.
Jill?
I'm Jill Lackett, and I'm a program coordinator with the Center for Collaborative Conservation.
Welcome, everybody. Okay. My fellowship was to do absolutely too much, and just to cast a very wide net. So I have a lot of information, but it's not as deep as it will be at some point. And because I worked in environmental conflict resolution for so many years, my first approach to any situation is to do a situation assessment. And what I wanted to do was to gather information in some kind of systematic way and find out about the conservation practice in natural resources and cultural conservation amongst Native Americans, Alaskan Natives, and Native Hawaiians, and then more specifically to identify specific individuals when I went and met them on their own lands who would be interested in designing a collaborative conservation process. So the fact that I wanted to travel to the places where people live meant that I traveled about 25,000 miles in about 18 months. And I would always try to picture what it was going to be like when I came to a tribal lands or place, and I never got the sense of it. It surprised me every single time. And I always did my homework if I were going to visit a specific tribe. And again, I was surprised every single time. So vast information gathering and a vast territory. I did not make it to Alaska, nor did I make it to Hawaii. That's for another day. And the methodology that I use seems a little bit contradictory to a situation assessment when I said a systematic kind of look, a strategic look at the information I wanted to gather. Charles Wilkinson at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who knows a lot about indigenous issues, I admire him very much, suggested that my methodology be that of a random walk. And a random walk is, I guess statistically, I don't know much about it. I know about the concepts, but I've never put numbers to it. But the idea is when you have a vast array of information that you want to get and a vast, I guess, data pool, you can put it that way, that you have different entry points and you sample in different ways. And so I experimented a lot. Sometimes when I would go onto a reservation, I would go to the Senior Citizen Center and have lunch because I could do that. Being what I am. Other times, I would make a formal request to appear before a tribal council. Sometimes I would just go to the Natural Resources Department. Sometimes I would have people who had recommended someone that I see, and I would see them. But because I was traveling so much, there were times when I just appeared on tribal lands, got out of my truck, and just walked. And that proved to be valuable as well. So there were many different entry points, and I was concerned that I not, after month of travel, that I not assume that I knew more than I did. And I am glad to reassure you all, I'm glad to tell you that at the end of this time of not only visiting lands, but doing a great deal of reading of books, law review articles, all sorts of things, I've really unveiled my deep ignorance. I found it very, very humbling. There is so much I don't know, and so much more to learn. So, any questions at this point? All right, I'll just keep going. I'm going to do something a little unusual. I'm going to give you my conclusions right now. And the reason for that is that I have a lot of slides and I have a lot of pictures which I want to show you. And so I'll give you my conclusions now, and then I'll take you a little bit on the journey that I just come back from. My conclusions are that the landscape of my situation assessment necessarily expanded from Native American, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian to indigenous peoples worldwide, globally. And the reason for that is that I discovered, and I had known this for quite a while actually, that Native Americans have been part of the establishment of human rights, indigenous rights, and now earth rights at the UN. And the UN is a body of customary law, basically established in 1945. And it's proving to be an amazing forum for indigenous peoples. And so Native Americans are connecting with indigenous peoples all over the world. The first time that I really saw this was when my mother and I took a trip out to the Pueblo country in 1994. And we were trying to find a home for a big pot that she had been given. It was obviously a Southwestern pot. And we wanted to give it back to the tribe rather than to the Smithsonian to be put, you know, in storage. And we were at the Tizuki Pueblo, and we walked into the tribal office, which was a house trailer at that time. And there was a Tizuki Pueblo man in traditional dress on the computer chatting with the Yamamamo tribe in Brazil. And I realized then that they were connecting. And my mother was an anthropologist, and in the next slide I'm going to show you just a little bit of my own history, or the slide after, because her methodologies actually for listening and for looking at cultures have become mine. And so I give this presentation in honor of my mother, who passed away a couple of years ago. So I discovered the UN initiatives in more detail. My mother had told me that Leon Shenandoah, who was an Onondaga, who is now deceased, who was the chief of the, basically the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee, went to the UN in the 80s and started to make the case for indigenous people. And I saw it develop. The voice of indigenous peoples is growing and present. They're often invisible or just not even thought of by many. Indigenous peoples at this point, I think, are about 6% of the world population, which makes them about 300 million. 70% of them are in Asia. In the United States, there are 3 to 5 million Native American, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians, 600,000 Native Hawaiians. And again, a small number, but I always look to the margins. There's often more activity, more creative thought, more movement at the margins, and these people are certainly at the margins. When I went into Louisiana, I decided to stop at the information center, and I asked if there were any Native American tribes in Louisiana, knowing that I was going to be appearing before the Houma Tribal Council in a couple of days. And the woman at the Visitor Information Center said, "Oh, there are no Indians in Louisiana, they all died out." Not true. I discovered also by reading books and law review articles that indigenous peoples are methodically deconstructing the collaborative conservation model. I am working on a working bibliography, which is many pages long, and trying to trace all of this is a fascinating study, and it is a study that is very strategically designed and very, very competently done. I have great respect for what they're doing. So one of the tasks for my fellowship was to identify Native American people who would be interested in designing their own collaborative conservation process. That's a long conversation, but I actually did identify more than 30 people who are willing to commit to this. I'm trying to work with the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder to house the next phase of what is like four phases of this project. My fellowship is part one, and hopefully that will go somewhere. The U.S. Institute for Environmental Conflict Resolution in Tucson has a group called the Native Network. I've been part of that since it began in the 1990s, and they're also interested in taking this project on. discovered relatively recently that about Earth Rights. And you know, if any of you have anything to contribute to what I'm going, you know, running by you much too fast, let me know. But the UN, there was a UN declaration created in Bolivia in 2010, and it said, basically, we understand that the Earth does not have standing, it is not a legal entity, therefore it is not included in what we are doing when we collaborate, when we resolve conflict, and it should be. And so there is a deep strategy that is moving along, including the a declaration for the UN, which they're going to be, I think, looking at next year. I also discovered that there is a US-based group called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, located in Pennsylvania. And they are dealing with hydraulic fracturing issues at the local level. They are creating local ordinances to give the earth standing. And the idea is that local governments can do that. They're waiting for a court case where they can wage a class action suit. And hopefully that court case will rule in favor. And if that is the case, then the earth rights will be in a court case as dicta. So my conclusion at the end of all of this is that mind, spirit, and place are connected. And that is a radical idea for me and maybe for many of you. So preface, I always try to look at my own cultural lens. And here is something for you to think about. What do you see here when you look at that? Anybody? Kathy?
I see a tree. And then a wolf.
Okay. Anybody else see anything?
Is that the border?
Beg your pardon?
Is that the Canadian-US border?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. This is the St. Regis Mohawk Reservation on the border of Canada and the United States. When the immigration law issues began to develop in Arizona, then they also translated here because there's a drug smuggling issue going across the border. But it's a much deeper issue for the St. Regis Mohawk than that. It is that their lands are both Canadian and US lands. So it becomes an issue of sovereignty for them. And just to quickly go through this slide, yes, that those flags are the Canadian border. That is a casino. I watched the Giants win the World Series one rainy night in that casino. And what this is it's an iron sculpture that, and there are a succession of iron sculptures kind of about this high that lead up to this casino. And it is a history that the Mohawks have turned from exploitation into art. And there was mining on Mohawk lands, pollution, and then hiring of Mohawks to be iron workers, and then there were no more raw materials, so they had the skills to work with iron, and so they have become artists in iron, and they are known for that. And the point that I really wanted you to get was that I took that picture, that I am behind that camera, that I photoshopped it, that I made it something, and so I chose to look at the art. I chose not to take pictures of the poverty. I've done that all along. Poverty is always there, but I was wanting to draw out something to move into the future with. So. And this is why I do this work. I lived on the Navajo Reservation for 3.5 years from the time I was 12 to 15. And this is Frank Mitchell. He is a Navajo medicine man. My mother had this picture forever, and when she passed away, it was given to me. This was done by Carl Gorman, who was a Navajo code talker, whose son R.C. Gorman is, again, now deceased, a commercial artist. And I had an experience when I was 12 years old on the Fort Defiance Plateau on the Navajo Reservation. We were gathering pinon nuts, a lot of us, and he came with us. And I was just so incredibly aware of him. He had an energy that just made you feel alive. I will never forget that. And there's an autobiography about his work and who he is that later came out. And to my surprise, the anthropologist who helped bring that, you know, was a friend of my family. This bracelet came in from the photographer. So there's a lot of history for me. And what he said on that day was, we were watching ants pull up garnets. And we were collecting the garnets as well as the pinyons. And he said to me, you know, that the anthills are moving up the plateau. And he said, that is a sign that, oh, maybe 30, 50 years from now, that the Indian way of looking at the world will come back. What was happening was that mining was beginning on the Navajo Reservation. And he said that, and I've never forgotten it. And so maybe that's, I'm still paying attention to Frank Benjamin. So, information gathering. What I did, when I've had more trouble doing this presentation than any presentation I can remember because there's so much stuff in my head. So I decided I would just download my brain, and this is one of three pages. And all of these things, you know, in a list, kind of trigger thoughts in my mind and issues and references and papers and that sort of thing. Embedded in there are 18 of the people who have agreed to design this collaborative conservation process, and then everything else kind of connects. So the challenge is to share with you something that you can look at in a half an hour or so and make sense of it, and I've decided to do it in pictures, basically. This is the heart of the Nez Perce country. This is the coast of California, and it looks like an empty landscape. And sure enough, the whole continent of the United States or America was perceived strategically so by the European colonists as an empty landscape. But of course, this was a very heavily managed, the whole of the continent was very heavily managed by indigenous people. And the Chumash people lived here. Right now it's a conservation area, and so no one is living on this coast, but the ecotourists can come and visit, and you know we can believe that we're alone. This is the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. And the White Earth Reservation is the home of Winona LaDuke and her organization called Honor the Earth. And she has been an eloquent spokesperson for indigenous rights. The reason I wanted to visit this reservation was because the White Earth people own very little of it. They are surrounded by lands that were lost during the allotment era to non-Indian people, and they're kind of claustrophobically in the center of the reservation with a few parcels here and there. And how do you live with that very easily? This is the Louisiana Bayou. This is the land of the Houma people. The Houma people, 17,000 people, are not federally recognized. I looked at the ruling on their application in the 1950s. It was a ruling that was not well done. It was done by two young anthropologists who said, well, you know, you don't have an unbroken written history, therefore we're not going to recognize you as a federal tribe. Their oral history is unbroken, and they are still trying to get federal recognition. This was during the brewing of the storm that went to Mississippi and Alabama with all the tornadoes, and the homeless say that when the Gulf, this is the Gulf Coast, this is where the BP oil spill was, that when the waters are churned up that way, that the column from the BP oil spill comes up to the surface and their fishing boats come back coated with oil and with the dispersant, which they look at under microscopes. They do not eat the fish that they fish. And because they're not federally recognized, EPA has pretty much ignored them. This is where I work. When I go to Black Mesa, I have two cases at the moment. One is in Wind River, with Wind River tribes in Wyoming, and one is with the Black Mesa traditional people in Arizona. And I am privileged to stay in the ceremonial hogan. It was about 4 degrees out there. And this is to remind me that even if I'm in a hogan, I still have a narrow view to the world. And this is the day I left. I was at Black Mesa for about 6 weeks. And I really found it important when I was doing these miles of touring to also have work that I had to deepen. And this is going to be about a 10-year project. I'm working with traditional people to help them survive together in this empty landscape where 16,000 of them were relocated because of the Peabody mine, and 600 of them are still there. This is the Wind River Reservation, and the snowpack, this is in May, the snowpack really still hadn't quite melted, and there was great concern that climate change, the melting of the Glenwood Gulf Glacier would bring flooding again. Almost didn't, but it didn't. It did last year, but not this year. This is Louisiana, and the trees are different, the air is different, the whole atmosphere is different, and that Spanish moss is just not sandstone. This is Canyon Guichet. This is on the Navajo Indian Reservation. And for me, when I work on the Navajo Reservation, I'm really coming full circle. This is where we used to hike. This is where Kit Carson conquered the Navajo by starving them and then took them on a long walk to Fort Sumter. This is coming home to Fort Collins. This is my home. This is my place. And it really, this, as I drove down 287, this is truly what I saw at the end of my trip. This is a reminder of what this land in Fort Collins is possibly. Heather Knight, Nature Conservancy, let me take this picture because I'm going to take this map to a man by the name of Mark Soldier Wolf, who's Northern Arapaho, whose people traditionally lived on this area, and I'm going to see if he has anything to tell us about what happened before we were here. So my assessment was to look at natural resource management, remediation, conservation, sustainable use, and also cultural conservation. So this is the part of the presentation is the collaborative processes that I found used on some of the reservations that I visited. And sometimes they were used either right out front there or in the background. That's kind of a new concept for me. This is the home rainforest. 1 mile, 1 square mile of land. They're right on the edge of the ocean. A river, the whole river goes through and out to the ocean, so they have riverfront. They are facing climate change issues. I think recently Congress has given them a land inland, and so they will be expanding. Collaborative process here is one that they created themselves. They said, we care about where we live. We have a long history and knowledge about it. But there are non-Indian people around us, so we're going to engage them. We're going to teach them. We're going to ask them to be our partners, and they have done that very well. This is the Midnight Mine Superfund site in Spokane, on the Spokane Indian Reservation. Some of you have seen these slides before. This is radioactive waste, the elk drink from that water. The mediation, the collaborative process that was used was to, you know, how do we relocate this waste? And it was one of many time-driven federal agency sorts of drills, and there will be more. It was not a deep solution. This is the Colville Tribe. This is the Grand Coulee Dam, a huge source of electricity and a lot of history in Washington State. The collaborative process does not really show here. That's the only picture of Colville that I had. But it is a non-Indian mediator, collaborator by the name of Jeff Goble, came to here, and he was also a resource manager person. And he was able to engage the traditional tribal people. He was able to ask them about their traditional environmental knowledge, and they became partners. And so they restored the woodlands, and I think that they quadrupled the economic output while preserving and improving the forest stand. This is the Klamath River. This is on the Yurok Reservation, the Karuk Reservation, and the Hoopa are also a part of this. And this is an example of a river that was heavily dammed. And this is in September, October, I believe. And the river is saturated with microcystic blue-green algae and toxic to the skin. People cannot swim in it. A collaborative effort was initiated, and the first phase of it, a situation assessment was not done, so they wasted time. I'm a great believer in situation assessments. But eventually they did create a successful collaboration process, and that was presented at our conference that we had a couple of years ago. Since then, the dams are gearing up to decommission the dams, to remove the dams. But there's another conflict, and the conflict is that even though the Karuk tribe has a newly developed multi-million dollar fish hatchery, they are ready to release steelhead trout, and the environmental groups who were allies with them are now adversaries because they are saying these are not native species, and therefore you're violating the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, environmental conflicts just go like this all the time. It's not just a one-time deal. Natural resource management, I bet there was collaboration here, but I bet it was behind closed doors. And I really feel that collaborative processes are prone to cronyism and action behind closed doors. And that, again, is why a situation assessment is so important, because you really need to know who should be at that table and how. This is a management of Louisiana wetlands. There are straight canals that go right to the sea because it enables commerce and oil to come up, tankers to come up. And this just seems metaphorical to me. It's very beautiful. But there's a barrier there to our natural process. The Homa tribe, 17,000, as I said, actually were originally part of the Mississippi Choctaw. They were forced during the 1700s to migrate, and they were dispersed by the pressure and the conflict between the French and the English. They sort of reconvened themselves on the Louisiana coast and became fisher people. And so that is now their history. But they are the Louisiana coast. It just was an amazing experience. The Homa have been saying forever that you need to restore our wetlands. You said you would, you didn't. And now the sea is eating away at our lands, and the whole system is in disequilibrium. And sure enough, that gridlock is actually visible. This is Coeur d'Alene. This was an upfront collaboration that I was actually a part of at EPA. And what I discovered when I did the situation assessment was that the tribe had applied for Clean Water Act delegation many years before, didn't get it. And since I was working in the Office of General Counsel, where the logjam was, I was able to, behind the scenes, speed up that Clean Water Act determination so that in my humble opinion, the tribe could come to the mediation table as a full decision-making empowered party. So power is always an issue when you're looking at a collaborative process. This is the Nisqually Reservation in Washington State. The Nisqually Reservation is on the McAllister River. McAllister is my heritage, Scott. And it's just an amazing experience to go there, because on this side is like there are traffic and malls and commercialism. You know, they're just on three sides of this reservation, and a military base that every once in a while, you know, shoots off guns and, you know, ordnance and that sort of thing. And you step in to the Nisqually Reservation, the energy changes entirely. It is quiet. It is vibrating with good energy. This canoe was, this is a traditional canoe. Billy Frank Jr. In the 1960s realized that his people had been given hunting and fishing rights, but the state was saying they didn't have them. So he became a protester and just started fishing. Ended up with a decision called the Bolt Decision, where the tribe was not given back because it was really not fair to be taken, but their fishing rights were resecured. Billy Frank, I've met him a couple of times. He's in his 90s, I believe, now. The first time I met him was at the opening of the Native American Museum in Washington, D.C. And then I met him in Washington State as well. He is a natural mediator and collaborator. He is the key person that can happen too. And he goes over to the military base and sits down and says, okay, how can we work this out? You know, this is what's happening to us. The force of his personality is what has really, I think, moved the fisheries issues in the Northwest into a very good place. So this is a natural resource. These are sheep that are owned by the woman that I work with on Black Mesa. And these are a special kind of sheep. They have a long history. They're from the Spanish. They're called churro sheep. They have long, beautiful hides, I guess. wool. And this is another thing. When I have found that when I'm working with indigenous people, and you'll hear this all the time, it's not always a straight line experience. And believe me, that is true. And there are many reasons, there are many layers of reasons why that is not, why working on these issues is not straight line when you're really working with the people who are living with the problem. I came back to the Navajo Reservation to do some work, and I had it all laid out, and I'd done my homework, and Marie Gladue, the woman you'll see her picture in a bit, said, Lee, I think it's time for you to herd sheep. And so, yeah, it was like 20 degrees, the wind was blowing, and she said, yeah, you need to know what this is all about. There are 23 sheep. Don't lose any of them. They're ready to drop, and if one does, just take it in your jacket and bring it back up. And by the way, there are boundaries here that you need to not go over. And she drew the boundaries in the sand. You know, here's the mesa here, here's this here. Well, I probably even have a disability about directions. Thank God for the GPS, but no help there. Although my cell phone did work, and so did hers. So she set me loose, and the sheep were all over the place. And for one moment, they were under that tree. So I got them. So I was out there for 5 hours, just hoping that I wasn't transgressing, you know, on some boundary that was invisible to me, but not to her. Bruno is no more. He met his end last Friday because it proved that ram just was aggressive. They neutered him, and he was still aggressive. And boy, that day, he was sure aggressive. There were two wild horses, and he kept trying to lead the sheep or the ewes over to those wild horses. Well, anyway, she was right. She was absolutely right. I needed to do that. And it was a very wonderful, humbling experience. Black Mesa. This is Black Mesa. If you Google it, you will see it's a huge expanse of many mesas, and that there's a gouge in the Black Mesa. The Navajos consider the Black Mesa to be alive in one of their four sacred mountains. It is the liver. And I first saw Black Mesa with my dad before there was any mining at all. And the Navajos didn't get a good deal. And I knew two of the lawyers who were the fathers of two of my friends, white friends, who were negotiating those leases. And I knew the daughter of the tribal chairman at the time. And it was not, it's they're trying to reopen it, because as time has gone on, more and more has been discovered by Charles Wilkinson in particular, about how a dispute was orchestrated. Going back to that slide, the Navajo and the Hopi have bumped up against each other for hundreds of years. And they were able to negotiate, collaborate, mediate their disputes of shifting boundaries. And the shifting boundaries were really informed by the weather, the conditions, the need of a sheep herding community versus an agricultural community. And of course, with these boundaries, there's a lot of intermarriage and cultural exchange, and so they managed it. John Boynton then came in to this dispute on behalf of Peabody Mine, and he became the Hopi tribal attorney, created a Hopi tribal council that was non-traditional and incredibly brilliantly escalated and polarized a dispute among the Hopis and the Navajos. And the result of that was fencing and the imposition of this boundary fence and a world of complication which still exists. And this is the Four Corners power plant. And when I was at EPA, we were trying to designate this area as a Class 1 watershed where air pollution like this would not be allowed. And what happens here is that the coal from Black Mesa is burned, as you can see. The people that I work with at Black Mesa have no water and no electricity, although Peabody Coal did promise them that. And this this electricity is going to Nevada and Arizona. This is the trading post at Black Mesa. And these are two of the traditional people in pictures of the traditional people who were still, they're called resistors, who were still living in that landscape, and the sorrow and their endurance. Black Mesa is directly behind this garage. This is the traditional pogon that I live in. That's another story to tell, but I'm running out of time. Roads are always an issue. That is frozen adobe. This is Marie Gladue and Dave Martecki. Dave is one of the fellows, and I also work with Village Earth. And what we are doing is we are trying to use Village Earth as sort of the administrative pass-through for some of the activities at Black Mesa. And Marie is a graduate student at Northern Arizona University, and she's trying to describe the Navajo planning, the Navajo cosmology to Dave. And I'm on her master's committee, and she's trying to complete her degree. What she's coming up against in academia is that the Navajo cosmology is not academically easy to kind of write about. And so we're trying to find a creative way to write her dissertation. Cultural conservation. I have been talking about culture as I'm talking about place. And that's something I think that holistic look is something we don't pay enough attention to. But But when you're talking about cultural conservation of a reset, frankly, I don't like that word. I don't want to be preserved or, you know, pickled. And she has a point, absolutely. But the issues that come up, sovereignty, borders, boundaries, justice, dispute resolution, is it restorative justice or punitive justice, indigeneity and identity, what is that? How do you define that? Jurisdiction, land tenure, always an issue, certainly in court cases, about who has jurisdiction. Historic trauma and colonization. 20 years ago, historic trauma was not really in the lexicon. It has become something that Native people speak more about and know more about. Dwayne Champagne at the University of California, Los Angeles, and I forget what his tribal affiliation is or what it is, but he said, we need to be able to say that this happened to us in the past, but we need to be able to bring that into the future as well. Sustainability, earth rights, how do you think about that, and the collaboration process itself. Culture. Native Americans value their elders. Mark Soldierwolf is the one I want to take that map to. He's in his mid-80s. He's a Northern Arapaho, and he is a certified elder, storyteller of the Northern Arapaho tribe. Elders, again, Wind River. This is Marlon Spoonhunter. This is William C. Hare, otherwise known as Icky John, and this is Pauline Oldham. These are elders of the Northern Arapaho tribe. Before I was able to work with the Northern Arapaho, I had to have permission of William C. Hare that I would be the person to do it. There are four old men. He told me there used to be three, but they're culturally innovative, and so now there are four old men, and they're sort of the council that rules behind the scenes. One of the issues with Native Americans all the time is traditional ways of governance and these imposed more formal tribal governments that were created in the 1930s so that there would be legal entities to negotiate leases with. This was a youth camp that the Wind River Alliance held, and this little boy is a drummer already. Stories. The stories of indigenous people are long histories, and Coyote, one of my favorites, is looking over. Art, as I said before, this is the Lummi Reservation in Washington. Identity by design. You know, indigenous cultures are not static cultures. Don't romanticize it. You know, they create mindfully and draw from the past and create the future as well. These are Northern Arapaho people who Robin has met. This is a more traditional dress. This is more of a fancy dress, and there's a lot of history. And this is a little blue moccasin Soldier Wolf. Her mother, Yufna Soldier Wolf, is a graduate student in physical anthropology, and she's going to go to law school. She's concerned about sacred sites and cultural preservation and the legality of all that, and she will be someone to reckon with. As part of her study, she had to have a cultural experience, so she decided she would go to the Lander Symphony, and she brought her daughter, and her argument was, this is as foreign to me as you're coming to a powwow is to you. And Lou Moccasin got up and conducted the orchestra in perfect time. This is the Florida Seminole. The Florida Seminole were sort of flushed out of the swamps and given sewing machines, and that was the only way they could make a living, so they did it, and they created this art. They are now wealthy. They were the first tribe to bring casino gambling into the legal system. They won the case, and all of the tribal casinos have the Florida Seminole to thank. The Florida Seminole have seven different sort of centers. One is a renegade center, and they will not have anything to do with gambling, and they're the most traditional people. The other people, as you go away from the sort of the central Seminole casino site, are more or less prosperous. The Seminoles the band that started the Gambly are incredibly wealthy, and they're having real issues with their children, each of whom could afford an SUV, and how do you be a traditional Seminole and still drive an SUV and be part of this culture? That's an issue that assimilation for all tribes. 50% of the Native American tribes are urban, and so there's that issue too. So anyway, sovereignty always an issue. This is the Red Lake Chippewa in Minnesota. This tribe was able to stay out of so much of the colonization experience. They never lost any of their lands to allotment. They have had a tribal government that has not changed through time, and they do assert their sovereignty. There is a young lawyer who is a White Earth member who is lawyer for this tribe. She is interested in becoming part of our collaboration training project. License plates. This is a mural in the Forest County Potawatomi area, and again, art. This is the Chumash. People who have a reservation, who are federally recognized the way so many tribes are not in California, and they had lost so much that they had to go to the Anthropological Record and the Historical Society to reconstruct their culture. They brought back their language, they have begun to recreate canoes, and there's this beautiful mural which is full of symbolism and history in downtown Santa Barbara that I visited when I went to a Native Network Exchange workshop. Again, art, this is the Tunica Biloxi, and language, the Mississippi Choctaw. Eastern Band and Cherokee language, a lot of history there. I visited a number of justice buildings and centers. This is the St. Regis Mohawk. The tribal judge is interested in becoming part of our project. This is the Seneca, part of the Iroquois Confederacy, and this is in New York, and they have quite an extensive legal system. This is the Mississippi Choctaw. Again, one of the judges wants to be part of our project. And this was, I had a conference call with you, Robin. it looks like it's cooler than it is. Anyway, the Mississippi Choctaw had a memorandum of agreement with the Houma people. The Houma people feel that because of what has happened with the BP oil spill and the hurricanes and the eating away of their land, that they may have to relocate back up to the Mississippi Choctaw, and they have signed a memorandum of agreement with the Mississippi Choctaw welcoming them back. Cherokee Nation, Oklahoma, there's the Eastern Band of Cherokee in North Carolina, and then most of the Cherokees, Trail of Tears, were relocated to Oklahoma, as were many other tribes. It seems there are Seminoles mostly in Florida, but there were Seminoles that came to Oklahoma, and they're beginning to connect, and the same the Cherokee. Onondaga, you'll notice collaborative, finding common ground, indigenous and Western approaches to healing our land and waters. Universities and tribes, this is Syracuse University, are connecting, and this is something that we need to pay attention to. Other universities. Border issues, again, the Mohawks and taxes, cigarette taxes, as well as jurisdiction over recent trust lands, all those sorts of things are hotly in the news, and there are certainly some angry Mohawk people. This was when I became an illegal alien. I actually, unknowingly, just simply drove from one part of the Mohawk reservation to what I thought was another, and I was interested in meeting with the Jesuits there because the Jesuits have been ethnographers for many tribes. And he told me, he said, you know, you're on Canadian land and you didn't go, you didn't get here the right way, you should have passed through the wicket.
We had a two-hour conversation, really not so much about the Mohawks, but we had a mutual interest in a French paleontologist called Théodore Desjardins, which actually influenced Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry's work on Earth rights has influenced this creation of Earth rights that we will deeply. Again, art. This is a Virginia tribe. There are no federally recognized tribes in Virginia. They are state tribes, but they continue to struggle and have for hundreds of years just to be. The Pamunkey, another Virginia tribe, they have a museum. Tunica Biloxi, they have become in Mississippi. They have become a laboratory, a massive laboratory. For Native Americans to send found facts to shore up the record that is not just oral history, the archaeological record. The Tunica Biloxi did this so well that they were able to become federally recognized when they didn't think they had a prayer. Mississippi Band of Choctaw, again, Choctaw self-determination. I talked to the curator of this museum for quite a while, and he said, you know, we shouldn't have to even think about Choctaw self-determination. What was taken away from us is something that should never have been taken away from us, and we should not have to reclaim what was ours to begin with. This is a museum, Eastern Band of Cherokee. The museum itself spoke to non-Indian people. It wasn't a museum for the Cherokee. I was sent to, I can't remember exactly the place where it was, but a museum that just ironically was run by Scots, and they were celebrating Scots history, bagpipes, and but I found the voice of the Indian people in that particular museum. And this is the casino in Seminole. Again, to repeat myself, these are my conclusions, and this is, you know, happy Halloween from Muckleshoots. And that's it, and I use it all the time, and I'm sorry. Any questions?
First, let's give her a hand.
And it's a few minutes before one, so if you have to go, you know, please feel free, but I'm sure that Lee would be, she is happy to take some questions and comments. But go ahead, you can field your own questions.
Thank you all. Yes, Faith.
It was very curious to me as you were talking about collaborative processes that you were showing landscapes, and I understand, you know, this is the title of your presentation, Indigenous Landscapes, and maybe of your project as well, but I wouldn't assume that. But it was interesting to me that they were just of the environment, that there were no people in those photographs, and only later you showed only a few pictures of some people and even a couple of portraits, but in the landscapes when you were talking about collaborative processes, there were no people, so I was curious as to why.
Thank you for picking that up. I did that deliberately for two reasons. Number one, I don't take pictures of Native American people just right off the bat. The pictures of the different people that I knew and that who wanted me to take those pictures, and I have permission to use those pictures. And the second reason is that, you know, my lens really was to just try to see what I could sense. And I had to do that very generally. You know, this is an outrageous thing to try to do. And so I was just taking in the sense of the land each time, and every time I found it so different that I thought, I'm just going to keep on doing it this way. So it's not that I don't like people.
No, I did figure.
Well, I wondered about myself, you know, I wondered, you know, why am I doing this? And it's out of respect, and just because I was paying attention to something else, too.
And I have a part two to that question. And then I'll start to that there's Alice Hobbs. One of the common themes in those photographs is water, and that's of interest to me as my view that pertains to my research, and wondered if you had some comments about the relationship between indigenous people and the places that you've been in and their water or lack thereof.
It was a lot about water, and I realized that when I selectively chose. I also have
a lot of experience in the West, but that wasn't the trip I was taking. I was just trying not to redo totally what I'd done before. You know, I think our legal systems, our Eastern riparian focus and our water rights focus here in the West really are defining. That said, you know, I don't know what more I could say except that the amount of water, the kind of water, the lack of water in a place really then is part of, you know, how these people are thinking about everything for just the common sense, obvious reasons. And then so much of this traditional environmental knowledge and the esoteric practices are way layers back as they need to be. What's happening though in Australia in particular recently is that the elders are saying our earth is in such trouble that we've decided to come forth and share what we know. And many tribes haven't done that, but some have. For instance, Colville. So the Colville tribe realized that they needed to do that.
Thank you.
So you've been doing this for a while, and meeting with a bunch of different kinds of people, and well, people with various mindsets. Were there mistakes you made that you thought, I sure wish I hadn't done that, that you could share?
Oh, totally, all the time. Oh, absolutely. For instance, when Marie Gladue was drawing the map on my on the ground in the sand, you know, I was desperate to get out my red book and copy. She said, "Don't do that." She said that will attract the spirits, and she erased it with her foot.
Oh.
And I was also asked not to take notes under most circumstances because the traditional people don't trust things being written down that can attract some negative energy. And so I had to learn to remember, and actually my memory has improved, and that's just fine at my age to improve. And I would write my notes at night. The most recent experience that I've had was just absolutely devastating. I was at this Native Network Environmental Skills Workshop. And my learning from this particular mistake is that, yes, tribes will say, we believe in restorative justice and healing justice. But behind that is a jurisprudence, and you can look at it that way, of bold-faced, or, you know, in bold protocols. This is how you do it. And I'm now going down to Hopi once a month to be trained to in the way that Hopis have modified this mediation process, and I am reminded of how important protocols are. Well, I missed some protocols. We were all speaking from our heart. This was half non-native and half native peoples. And the native person who spoke first looked at me as a white woman and had assumptions about me and you know what I brought, and which were unfair, but of course always partly true when you're non-Indian. And so as the conference went on, you know, this native, non-native divide deepened. And there was a healing ceremony at the end of the first day by the woman, Roberta Cadero. She's a PhD, Chumash, and she, you know, it was a healing ceremony. It wasn't clear to any of us non-Indians that we were invited. You know, you're always inside, outside. This identity thing is huge. Sometimes I'm asked to be part of family. Sometimes the kids will look at me as an elder. You know, that's bizarre because, and then other times you'll just come up, slam against it. You are not us. And that's, you know, it's a very complicated piece. Well, what happened was, the protocol for that healing was that we were invited, but they didn't tell us that. They assumed that we knew that. And so those of us non-Indians who were like heartsick about how much we try and how unappreciated we were feeling, missed that. And of course, when you have to deal with all of this stuff, that protocol is so useful because it says, now we stop grieving, now we start moving into the future. Well, I was still feeling battered. And so the next day I was actually on a panel and I spoke to that feeling, to my non-Indian, and the Navajo who was actually facilitating this meeting, and who was a good friend of mine, at the end of my session pulled me out and said, Lee, what the hell did you do? What were you thinking? And I said, well, I was speaking from my heart. And he said, that was totally inappropriate. And, you know, like a body slam of dismay and embarrassment. And but as time has gone on, you know, and I got over my angst, we all realize that this is a systemic problem, that we need to fix it, and that, you know, the white people need to know these protocols, which are really fierce. So I had violated that unknowingly. So there you go. Okay. That's the one I didn't tell you that I said I might.
I'm really sorry to bring this to a close because it's so interesting. So please catch up with Lee. We're going to whisk her off to lunch. And thank you very much for coming, and thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you.